Today we are going to be learning on a fascinating topic. This is called the most controversial day after in Jewish history. I feel like after Pesach we're on that day after right now. We're just surviving, just got through everything. And actually it turns out to be a very consequential day. In fact, today's day in Jewish history happens to be a very consequential day. Sunday after Pesach. You think, well, does Sunday after Pesach have anything special? The answer is yes, but just depends where you come from. So let's start at the beginning. This is the discussion which circles the topic of Sfiras HaOmer in general. The Torah has a section in Vayikra Chaf Gimel, the 23rd chapter in Vayikra, in which it describes, as we say in the Kiddush on Yom Tov, Ele Mikraya Kodesh Shetikros on Bema Adam. These are the Mikraya Kodesh, the holy convocations is usually the way it's described, the times you call out. In holy, you will call them at their gathering times, at their specific set-aside times. So it's clearly about all the moments in the year that are dependent on the nation of Israel's calling of them being holy. And so included in that is Pesach, Shavuos, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot. All of those are listed in chapter 23, Perek Chof Gimel, and Vayikra. And that makes sense because all of them depend on the calendar description, the calendar decision, essentially, of the people of the basin, essentially. Quick interruption, just to wish Alan a special mazel tov on the birth of a granddaughter this morning. Mazel tov. Fresh off the press, Be'ezra Hashem, continued smachos. What a special way to start the year after Pesach. So it's going to be a day after to remember. So in and amongst this, and by the way, why is it that it's dependent on the Beis Din to make that decision? The answer is because, as you know, that the lunar cycle is not exactly precise when it comes to our day cycle. So the Earth spins on its axis, taking 24 hours. That's amazing. How did it take exactly 24 hours? The answer is because we divided it up by 24 sections afterwards, and we created the hours. It worked perfectly. And then what happens is that system of time does not match the system of time that it takes the moon to do a full orbit around the Earth. By the time it comes back, it is 29.5, and then a few extra decimal places of time, of days. So a problem, because if we want to count time based on the amount of the moon goes around us, then we can't really say it's a certain length of days because it's half a day. So we have a little bit of a problem. So the way that it worked in the times of Chazal would be that the witnesses would come and say whether they saw the moon on day one, which is essentially the 29th day or the 30th day. And depending on what they saw would be whether the month was contracted or expanded, and therefore to affect the falling out of Yom Tov and so on. So it was dependent on Beis Din's decision based on the witnesses, and that's how it used to work. And those are called Mikra'e Kodesh. In and amongst them, we hear this whole section over here, which has a lot of consequence to where we are today, which starts as follows in the first source. You cannot eat all types of grain products until this day. There's a day beyond, before which one cannot eat grain products, and we call that, this is the halacha of, we call it Yashon and Chadash, which means that an entire year's worth of grain cannot be eaten until a certain day when the korban is brought. What's the name of that korban? That's called the korban ha'omer. We call counting the omer from the time that the omer or sacrifice is brought. And so the Torah tells us that there's this very important rule, which it has really far-reaching ramifications, certainly if you're living in Eretz Yisrael, about what you can eat and what you cannot eat. Then the Torah tells us, there's another thing that starts on that day that the Korban HaOmer is brought, and that is you start counting these 7 weeks. And then there's another sacrifice. It's called this new mincha, the new meal offering. Amazing. And that we call that time Shavuos. Right? So Shavuos happens those 50 days or 7 weeks later. So it is all wonderful. The only thing that's a little bit out of sorts over here is the fact that it uses the language of Mimacharas HaShabbos, the day after the Sabbath. You see, that sort of should stand out to us because nothing else in this chapter really talks about Shabbos. This chapter is all about Mikra'e Kodesh. Those are things that we call out as holy. Shabbos is not something you call out as it's holy. Yes, you can take in early Shabbos, and yes, there's a mitzvah l'kadosho. There's a mitzvah to do kiddush, even though it's kviyah v'kayma. But in the end of the day, whether you like Shabbos or you don't like Shabbos, it's there. It's coming. It's not dependent on us. It is not a mark in the year. It's a mark in the week. It's not based on a celestial event. It's not, and ultimately, it doesn't seem to fit into the language of this chapter. But it's very consequential because this is the only time date that we really get for the accounting of the Omer, and when this should be is Mimacharas Shabbos, the day after the Sabbath. And so it presents a lot of questions in Jewish history, so much so that the Mishnah tells us in Menachos that it describes the process of how they would bring the Korban Omer. Right? Today we don't have the Korban Omer, we just have counting the Omer pamphlets. But in those days, in the times of Beis Hamikdash, they would have the actual Korban Omer, and it was a grain offering brought out of which grain? It was a barley sacrifice. Okay, the barley's starting to ripen. If you go to Israel right now, you go out and look in the fields, the barley's coming up earlier, the wheat is coming up later in a few weeks' time. So the first of the grains to come out is barley, and this is the sacrifice brought from barley. So the Mishnah tells us there's a really beautiful ritual that surrounded this. So the Mishnah tells us over here in the second source, Ketzad ha-yohein oisin. So what would be the process? Shluchei beisin yotzim erev yom tov v'oisin oisoi krichos b'mechubar l'karko kedei she'en noach l'kliktsor. So they would go out to the fields, and they would, before yom tov, they would make bundles. They would put sheaves together, even though it's still attached to the ground, so it makes it easier when they come on yom tov to do this. And then it goes, Kol ha'yaros ha'smuchos l'sham, miskansos l'sham kedei she'en niktsar b'esek gadol. And there would be these gatherings, and people would come, and it would be a whole big to-do surrounding the Omer. Kevan shecha shecha, when it became dark, Omer lohem, bo ha'shemesh. So they said, has the sun set? Omer hain. It has set. Bo ha'shemesh, it checks again, has it set? Omer hain. Magalzu, is this a sickle? Omer hain. Magalzu, is this a sickle? Omer hain. Kupazu, is this a basket? Hain. Kupazu, is this a basket? Omer hain. Folks, this was not a copy and paste error. This is done multiple times. This procedure was repeated. But Shabbos Omer lohem, Shabbos zu. If it was on Shabbos, meaning to say, if the day that it cut the Omer was happened to be on a Saturday, on the Sabbath, they would say, is this Shabbos? Omer lohem, Shabbos zu. Is this Shabbos? They're ascertaining again. Omer lohem. Ektor ve'isha katet, hem omrim ksor. Ektor, hem omrim ksor. Shra katet, and they said, cut it. Sounds very pedantic, right? So the commissioner says, Sholosh pomim al kol davar v'davar. In fact, there would be a repetition of three times. You know, I remember reading about this, that in the operating theater, there are certain times where people are more tired. And certainly the early afternoons or later on in the shift. And so there's certain protocols as to the team talking to us. Our anesthesiologist in the room can talk to us a little bit about this. But they're really saying what they're doing and their role and what they're about and the instrumentation. So putting oneself into the space, it sounds like we're about to perform a very complicated operation. And everybody's making sure that we have everything correct. So the Mishnah says, like, but why so much? Like, why do we go to such lengths? So the Mishnah says, yes, kolkach lama, ibnei baitus, and show you omrim, and kitziras omer b'motze yom tov. They would say that it wasn't on Motze Yom Tov, on the night going out of Pesach. That was not when it happened. This group called the baitusim would not agree with that as well. So we have to think, what do the Baitusim say? But it's clear from the Mishnah that the way they structured this, and especially around Shabbos, interestingly enough, if the second day of Pesach was on a Shabbos, they were very careful to make sure that everything was in place. So as is well known, during the Second Temple time, there were many, many different groups of Jews. Many sectarian groups of Jews. You know, I always, when I grew up, we learn and talk about the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam. You know, like we think about, you know, the Jew who was mocking the other, you know, the Jew's got a different color yarmulke, you know, like, it was a lot more complex than that, right? We had a lot of different groups. So we had Baitusim and Sidoikim and Shamronim, and we had, at the end, we had Sikari, and we had a lot of Biryonim, we had a lot of different groups all fighting with each other, Qumran. There was a lot of different Jews, and it wasn't as if they even had much overlap. in terms of practice. There's a lot of complexity. So here we have an example of a divergence in practice. And this group of the Baitos, and what would they precisely do? What was their argument? What was their difference in opinion? So we know because we can read from some of their texts as an example. So take a look at this example in the Book of Jubilees, which describes the Shomronim or the Essenes position. And this is a translation. In the fifth year of the fourth week of the Jubilee, in the third month, what's the third month of the year? We call that? We call that Sivan today, right? In the middle of the month, Abram made a feast of the first fruits of the harvest of grain, and he offered up a new sacrifice upon the altar, first fruits for the law, for the food of the Lord. So what's this festival of first fruits? We call that Bikurim. When is Bikurim brought? Only at Shavuos. When is Shavuos being celebrated? Well, according to his count over here, it's the 15th or around the middle of the third month, right? According to the Book of Jubilees, which is the position of the Shomronim, so it was in the middle of the of Sivan. How could that possibly be? Why were they celebrating Shavuos in the middle of Sivan precisely? So apparently, it seems from the way this interpretation worked, and this was the predominant view during the second Beis HaMikdash, that Mimacharas HaShabbos was translated literally as the Sabbath, the Saturday. And then the question becomes, which Saturday are we talking about? Well, in the previous paragraph in the Torah, it just finished talking about what's called Chag HaMatzos, the festival of the unleavened bread. We just finished the festival of unleavened bread, so when would Mimacharas HaShabbos be? The Sabbath following Pesach, which, by the way, folks, is today. Okay? So that's precisely today. So according to the Shomronim, today is the day in which the count of the Omer starts, which shifts us essentially on a year like us already 10 days off center, which would put Shavuos when? In the middle of Sivan, right? Which is precisely what the Book of Jubilees is describing. That's how the Omer count would work according to the Shomronim. Now, it's a little more complex, because he doesn't say in our particular year. He says in general. We have to come back to that in a second because it's a little more complex. But that is the position that the Mishnah is referring to when it refers to the Baitosim, that this group of people will do this, which is why now we understand why the Mishnah's emphasis on the Shabbos constellation. Meaning, remember what the Mishnah was saying? It's saying if the second day of Pesach, the 16th of Nisan, was on a Shabbos, that's particularly when they would ask for extra affirmation. Is it Shabbos today? And the reason is because they particularly want to acknowledge that Mimacharas HaShabbos refers to the first day of Pesach, as we understand it to be traditionally, and not the Saturday. And so that constellation would be a perfect example of how it undermines the Baitosim's position, so much so that even if the second day of Pesach is on a Saturday itself, we would break Shabbos because to facilitate the Ksiras HaOmer. As well. Okay, so that seems to be his position. Now, it turns out, folks, they are not the only players on this field, because as it goes further, in fact, there was another group later on, post-Migdash, called the Karaites, and they're still around, who also were biblical literalists, and we have their writings. They had a different interpretation, again, ignoring most of the oral law that explains this, that gives us where we get to, but we have from the book called Gan Eden, written by a Karat sage called Aaron ben Elijah Eliyahu. And he spends a lot of time in his book talking about this particular topic. And this is, again, from the Karat position. This is not mainstream traditional Judaism, but this is the way he understands it. He says, Adavur Macharas HaShabbos, when the Torah says the next day following the Sabbath, Yesh Ladas, you should know, Ki HaChaluka Ravso Bein Chachmei HaKaraim Ubein Chachmei HaRabanim. There's a debate between the Karaite rabbis, the Karaite sages, and the sages of the rabbis as well. Now, folks, I don't know if you've met any Karaite rabbis. It seems that debate was lost. There is not so much left to talk about. But nonetheless, Shanachnu Amrim, we the Karaites say, Macharas HaShabbos Bereishis. It's the Saturday of Bereishis, meaning a Sunday, right? Shabbos Bereishis means not a festival, but rather Saturday found in the week. Right, v'hein omrim macharas yom tov, and they said it refers to yom tov. And now his reasoning, ki lo matzon b'chol ha-kosu shenikra ha-moed Shabbos. Never else in the Torah do we find that a moed is called a Shabbos. How can you reinterpret the text to mean that this time when it says the day after the Sabbath refers to Pesach? Because it never really does that elsewhere. Now, is he 100% correct? Not exactly, right? Because it does call a number of festivals Shabbason. Now, maybe not Shabbos precisely, which is what he's saying, but there is the idea where Shabbason is applied to a non-Saturday. Okay, just to be clear, is ba'avur she'ektim perek akodem shivas yamim matzos toichelu v'avapi shu perek mufrad tia yidiasoy sheba al shivas yamei matzah ba'avur ha'shabas she'esh b'shivas yamei matzah. So he would say the Karaite position was, if the previous topic was in Perek Kof Gimel and Vayikra is Pesach, and then it says Mimachras HaShabbos, it must refer to the day after Saturday, referring to Sunday. But which Sunday says this this individual Aaron ben Eliyahu, this Karat? He says it refers to Sunday within Pesach, which means when would the Karat counting of the Omer start? Would have started last Sunday. 1 week ago, that would be in Shabbat, Sunday Chol HaMoed, would have been the beginning of the Karaite counting. Why? Because their interpretation of Mimachras HaShabbos started just a little earlier. Same idea, the very literal interpretation of the Torah, but just a little bit of equivocation as to when the starting point is as well. So these are the positions, and these positions have continued throughout history. In fact, these are the and only really ended when the different groups have sort of petered away. But that's the perspective. Now, the question is okay, so from the world of Parshanut, how do we stand up to this? It sounds like we know something that they don't. So what is it that we know? So there's a few things which are worthwhile knowing, which are worthwhile considering. Number one, which is worthwhile understanding, because it sounds like we are in the defense. We're called traditional Judaism is in defense because we are reinterpreting the verse. Rather than Mimachras HaShabbos meaning a Sunday, it means the day Yom Tov. When else does it ever mean Yom Tov? So the truth is that it's worthwhile considering the following fact. There are two festivals which we misinterpret as one. And that is, when I tell you the word Pesach, what does that refer to? We just finished Pesach, right? So it refers to a seven, or in the diaspora, an eight-day holiday, right? Well, not exactly. That's not what the Torah says. You see, the Torah actually says, if you look at the way the Torah describes it in Source 5, Bachodesh Arishon, in the first month, that's called Nisan, Barbaasor Yom Lachodesh Ben Arbaim Pesach Lashem. On the 14th day in the afternoon, that's called Pesach. Folks, when was that? What day was that? Okay. That's called Erev Pesach. That's what the Torah calls Pesach. Why would it be called Pesach then? Because that's when you bring the Korban Pesach. That's when the whole ritual slaughter is taking place. Fifth Perek in Maseches Pesachim. Ratamid Nishrat, that's all happening then. Three groups in the Azara, shechting, flaying, the whole business, that's happening then. Then the Torah continues. Then after that, there's a seven-day festival called Chag HaMatzos, the festival of the unleavened bread. Now, I guess it's a little longer, so people kind of adopted the other one, and we use the same word for both, so we really call the seven-day festival Pesach, but that's not particularly true biblically, right? That's not 100% true biblically. There were two festivals. One was Pesach, which is the afternoon of the 14th, and then there was Chag HaMatzos. Now, if that's the case, and now we're in biblical territory, so we're reading the Torah, how would the Torah convey the second day of Pesach, the second day of this festival? See, I already did it myself there, right? How would it convey it? If the Torah were to say, Mimacharas ha-Pesach, what day would that be referring to?
The first day.
That would be referring to the 15th, right? The Torah just told us that the 14th is Pesach. So if it were to say, Mimacharas ha-Pesach, that wouldn't work. If it were to say, Mimacharas ha-Matzos, then what day would that refer to? The day 8 after Pesach, right? So neither of those options are actually very viable at this point in time, according to the way the Torah has described these two festivals. Fair? So what else could the Torah possibly say? Well, it has told us that the first day is the Mikra Kodesh, that is, of Matzos, is a holy convocation. So Mimacharas HaShabbos is perhaps the only viable alternative to describe the day, the 16th of Nisan, right? Because it's the day of cessation of...
That would mean the day after the second day of Pesach.
You're right. There's a little bit of interpretation, a space for interpretation. But if you think about it, if you wanted to get to the 16th, this is the closest we could get with the tools, with the language being described. We don't get that because we would say, we'll just say, Mimacharas HaPesach. Well, that wouldn't work. That's not actually biblically accurate.
Why
okay?
Not say the 16th?
You're right.
So there's a reason for this. And this gets down to ideological considerations. We're not in ideology yet. We're going to get back to what the debate is. Yeah, yes, Chaya.
Why is there so much opening for misinterpretation? Good. Like, why couldn't
you just say it? Yes, this is the big question. The big question is folks, you know, why beat around the bush? Why make create all this haze? Let's just say, the Torah should say explicitly 100% what's going on here. I think what's at a foot here is an incredibly important ideological debate. I want to open that up and peel away that piece. So, yeah, Timmy?
I'm just saying, we have, like, for example, what can't you do on Shabbos? The Torah tells you one thing about a fire.
So the emphasis on, we'll get to the Torah Shabbat aspect of it in a moment, that's the most famous perspective, but I want to come back to this, but we have to decide why, which Chaya's question is why here, why is this the place that it emphasizes. Now, happens to be that there's another point in history that we ought to look at, where the Torah interprets itself. Right, so like, you know, we don't need great sages of the Karaites to start telling us what they think. The Bible tells us about the Bible, which means to say that if you want to read the Torah and you want to understand the Torah, you need to read Nach as an explanation of Tanach. Fair? Right? Because there are events that occur in Nach which will help us understand what happens in the T of the Tanach. Right? Fair? So we have one of those. It's explicit, folks. It's explicit. So listen to what happens. Say for Yoshua, we read this as Zayif Torah. And folks, for those who are awake and listening, it'll be first days of Pesach. This was, you say for Yoshua, Perakei. The reason why this is quoted as our Torah is because it actually is very parallel. It's right. The nation of Israel enters the land of Israel during Nisan. They cross the Jordan on the 10th of Nisan. And then on the other side of the Jordan, this is when we pick up over here, there is a large circumcision ceremony. All the men who have not been circumcised are circumcised now, which sort of echoes back to Pesach Mitzrayim. Right, in order to have the Pesach Mitzrayim, there was circumcision and then Korban Pesach. The blood of Korban Pesach and the blood of circumcision are linked in these two historical moments. And there is a circumcision ceremony as they enter the land of Israel. And then we hear about the following in the source in Yoshua. Vayachanu b'nei Yisrael ba-Gilgal. So the nation of Israel is in this area called Gilgal, which is really essentially just on the west side of the Jordan River. That's where they are encamped, just on the outskirts of Jericho. And they bring the Korban Pesach on the afternoon of the 14th on the outskirts of Jericho. Right? And that's the festival called Pesach. That's the 14th of Nisan. Good. Everything works. Then, the next day, what date are we on now? The 15th of Nisan, they eat me'avur ha'aretz. From? What's Avura Aretz? The grain of the land. Just at this point, it's all new because they've never been in the land of Israel yet. Matzois v'kolui b'etzem hayom hazeh. And they eat. They make these unleavened breads from the produce of the land. Now, they did not cultivate this. They weren't there. So they probably took it, bartered it, traded it, conquered it, whatever it is. But they have now grain from the land of Canaan, right? As they now the land of Israel as they start entering it. Vayishpos haman mimacharas. And the manna is finished. The day afterwards, what day is that? 16th. When they started eating from the grains. Says the Rambam in his interpretation or his understanding, in his halachic interpretation in the Yad HaChazaka, in the halachas of Tmidim and Musafin, he goes through the whole ceremony that we saw in our Mishnah beforehand. About the whole, you know, is this a sickle? Is this a date? Like all that. He says, why did we go such extents in the ceremony? Because of those who are unfortunately misled. Who left being part of Israel. Right? These groups actually is correct. They never returned. These groups were sectarian groups, drifted from the mothership and never returned. They say it's a Sunday that the Omer starts on. But through we have the tradition, it refers to Yom Tov, and therefore it's the second day of Pesach. And we know that the Korban HaOmer was always brought on the 16th of Nisan, traditionally for all throughout all the generations. You cannot eat any of the new grains until this day. But Neymar, and this is corroborated by the experience that happens on the banks of the Jordan. You're going to say that it happened on a Sunday? And therefore, Pesach and the first day of what we call Pesach, and it happened to be on a Saturday, and therefore it matched up that year. And that's the way the Karats would interpret it. He says, how would the Torah say that they start eating the new grain on something which was circumstantial because it happened to match up with Saturday, when really it's not actually inherently connected to that? It's really the festival which allows it is Pesach, not Shabbos. That's the we'll call it the gateway to accepting this. And that's what the Rambam interprets over here. So just looking at a few basic logical points from the actual text itself, it seems that there are very significant reasons for what we'll call the rabbinic traditional view. However, the question really is what's at stake in this debate? What's really the two sides over here, ideologically? And why was this so obscure? Why is this so important for us to understand? So I'd like to offer three basic interpretations. Not so basic. The first is a classic interpretation. The less is an academic interpretation. And the third is really just a beautiful ideological perspective from Rabbi Sacks. I'd just like to go through each of those three, and I think each one is quite remarkable. The most basic level of understanding as to what is at stake over here is if I were to say to you, what is the debate between the Baitusim or the Shomronim or the Essenes and the Purushim and the traditional Judaism? The main departure point is, what are they arguing about? Well, is that? No, that's a symptom of what their argument is. The argument is about Torah Sheval Peh. Is there an oral Torah? Do I have a biblical Torah? Do I have a biblical tradition along with a oral tradition? Is the oral tradition interpreting, allowing me to understand what is in the biblical tradition? That's the most basic understanding. And if you look at through the Gemara seems to be replete with this, because if you look at all the Gemaras that follow in Menachos, like Rabbi Lezer says, Eino tzorich harei u'omer tispor lecha sefira tuluya bebeistin shalohem yoidim lechadesh mimachras ha-shabbos mimachras yom tov yotzos ha-shabbos bereshish yisfirosu b'chol adam. To get to Shavuos, you need Beis Din, because the language used of Tisporlach, of you should count, in singular refers to Beis Din, not every individual, which means that Shavuos can only be interpreted by Beis Din. But if it's about if it's from Sunday every year, then you don't need a Beis Din to figure that out, right? Because ultimately, everybody can count from Sunday. So it has to be something which is started by Beis Din on a day which is not which shifts every year. Well, which day shifts every year? Well, the day after, the first day of Pesach, as we call it, does shift every year because it's up to the Beis Din's interpretation based on when Rosh Chodesh Nissan is. So that's an example. And there's four different opinions. Rabbi Yeshua has an opinion where he describes that it's just like a month is dependent on Beis Din, so too Atzeres, which is Shavuos, is dependent on Beis Din. Rabbi Shmuel has another idea over here, which is just like the Korban Ha'ashtei Alechem is brought on Shavuos at the beginning of the festival, so Omer must be brought at the beginning of the festival and by parallel to Pesach. Then we have Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira, who describes that it does say Shabbos by Yom Tov later on in the Perikov Gimel. All these reasons, are these causative reasons? Are these, meaning like these four Rabbonim, these great, the great sages of the Mishnah, these old Tanaim, were these sages looking into the Pesukim and saying, because of my reason, I arrived at this answer? I don't think so. What are they really saying?
That you need Torah Shabbat.
What they're saying is that we know the answer, right? Meaning, tradition has it that Moses told us on Har Sinai that the words we mocharas for Shabbos refer to Yom Tov. It refers to the day after Yom Tov. We know that. Now, the question is, well, how do you do the look at that from the text perspective? So this is what would be called an asmachta, which means to say, they're saying, okay, well, how do we get there? How is it we link the text and the tradition? They're not saying that, oh, based on these ideas, that's how I arrived at it. That's why there's so many disparate views. What they're essentially saying is, we know this is true. We want to show you the Baitusim, how we get there, you know, from a perspective of exegesis, and we'll show you how to extrapolate it. Okay, we'll give you interpretations. But it's clear, I think it should be clear from this Gemara, that these are not the reasons, These are hooks that they'll find to hang their coat on, but we know it. Which means to say that the real debate is do you accept the fact that there is an extra biblical interpretation or tradition which helps us understand these things or not? And in fact, Rav Kook points out one step further. He has a set of tshuvas called Mishpat Kohen, which are lesser known writings of Rav Kook, and he points out that there's another debate had around the Omer as well with the Baitusim as well. Anybody familiar? This is not the only debate that that's had around the Omer in their misinterpretation of the Torah. There's another.
Shabbos and Orban Moshe Roset.
Okay, no, good. The one that he points to is, take a look at the source 9, right hand column. He says, starting in the middle of the line of the writing column, "Vanochi bi'arti nyan zeh bekesher shel shtei haprotzos shelahem." There are two, we'll call it breaking through of the barriers that they made. Shein b'kedushas Torah sheba alpeh. Both of them relate to the oral Torah. She ikar abris shekoras Hakadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael b'shvila. That's the main way that Hashem made a covenant with us. Shein shzumucha zulazu. He says, let's just say one second. We're going to skip those two lines to the line which starts with deshavu aya. Umash rotz tzedakim she yachid yia misnadev umevi tamid. There's another machlokes which relates actually not specifically to the Korban Tamid, but to what's called the Korban Tamid. And that is out of debate as to who paid for the Korban Tamid. Who paid for the sacrifice that was brought on a daily basis? The Purushim understand that it comes from the public coffers, whereas the Baitusim understood it came from the private coffers of the priests who had to bring it as well. It was they were representing, so they brought it as well. So Rav Kook says maybe these two misinterpretations, number one as to when the Omer was brought, and number two as to where the money came from for a sacrifice, are related. He says because ultimately what they are denying is not just that there's an oral Torah. He says because the oral Torah, let's understand what means that there's an oral Torah for a second. The Gemara says that when it came down time to write down the oral Torah, the Gemara in Gittin tells us, by writing it down, there was a great sacrifice that was made. And it was a Horaz Shah, it was an emergency situation that they needed to write down because of the diaspora Jewry under persecution around the 2nd century. They really did this. They're going to the 3rd century, that's when they wrote down the Mishnah. What was the sacrifice that was made? What do you lose by writing things down? Like, what's the big deal? Like, well, why is it Heferu Torah Secha precisely?
Adaptability.
Oh, so there's a lot of losses. There's a lot. The misinterpretation, adaptability. You know what the Tosafos says? Tosafos says on that Gemara, I'll give you a very simple reason. Gemara says like this. He says, the Torah Shebichsav has been abrogated, copied and pasted, and absorbed by every other major religion, monotheistic religion after us, right? Christianity, Islam, all of those religions accepted it, swallowed it, and done. Finished. But what's the part that distinguished us as the nation of Israel? Was the Torah Sheba'al Peh, because it was not able to be copied and pasted so easily. Nobody could just come along and take it and say, this is us, which is why Christianity is absent of that, which is why Islam is absent of that. They created their own Torah Sheba'al Peh, called the Hadith, but they did not take our Torah Sheba'al Peh, although, you know, although Muhammad did certainly, you know, Islam is based on the pagan and Jewish traditions in the Arabian Peninsula, which is where when he created Islam in the 7th century. But be it as it may, the Torah Sheba'al Peh was not available for abrogation. When we wrote it down, now we're essentially offering it. It's like putting up, you know, on free on the internet, essentially, you know, the text, the availability. Now people can interpret, misinterpret, adapt in such a way. That was what was said, which leads many of the great Jewish thinkers to suggest that the real connection that Hashem has with the nation of Israel is not through the biblical Torah, because that is, so to speak, open. That's an open source. It's really through the Torah Sheba'al Peh, which is unique to us. So their denial of the Torah Sheba'al Peh, argues Rav Kook, is not a denial only of one corpus of material of our academic research. It's really about the uniqueness of the people Israel. That's essentially what the argument is, which expresses itself in numerous ways as well. So another expression of that is in the fact that there, when you put together a lot of different people, There may be a social contract between those people. We'll get a fire department, a police department, garbage removal. That's the social contract of living together. But that will not create a new entity called Knesset Yisrael, the nation of Israel, right? Which is why when you have a group of people coming together, they bring a korban. Whoever's in charge brings it. It's the roster, you know, whoever pays for it. But the idea that there should be a new entity called an enterprise called Knesset Yisrael, they were not prepared to accede. Which is the same idea of denying that there's something unique and special about Israel in the first place. He goes on further to say, and that's how it relates, this is just a very esoteric point, but it's his interpretation of this. In the second column on source 9, the last words in the line is Val-Kain. He says, it's an abbreviation of Val-Kain, Korah Torah Yom Tov Rishon Shel Pesach, Shu Regel Rishon Tchilas Utchila L'Regalim. That's why the first festival called Pesach is actually called Shabbos. B'shem Shabbos, la'roish shekedushas Yom Tov ha'ma'acheres es haklal mekedushas Shabbos mi'yisod ha'Torah hu yonekes. Is to show us that the festivals, which are holy convocations where people come together, is nursing its kedusha out of something which God gave kedusha to. Meaning, we declare when Pesach is because that's in our hands. But where does our convocation get its, we'll call it energy from? Where does it come from? Shabbos. Meaning, did we declare Shabbos? No. That was. There's no orbit. There's no astrological phenomena which reflects the Sabbath, the 7-day cycle. That God told us. That's my sign. Where do the rest of the festivals? Where does the first of those festivals draw its energy from? From the Shabbos itself. Which means, I'm telling you that there's something bigger than just getting together. I'm telling you something bigger than just being in the land and bringing sacrifices. I'm telling you that there's something larger afoot. And that's called Kedushas Knesset Yisrael, which the Baitus they missed. They just view this as a society. We get together, there's a social contract, we work things out. But that does not mean to say that now there's this entity which is responsible for Grabanos. It doesn't mean that there's this entity which nurses its Kedusha from the Shabbos itself. Very esoteric. We missed this point. It's all right. We're going to move on to another idea, but this is just a very fascinating spiritual interpretation of this as well.
Is the reason this is called a Shabbos?
Correct. We start off the entire Yom Tov circuit, which is Pesach, by calling it a Shabbos to understand that there is this is not simply a gathering place where we hang out with our families and go on trips.
Would this sort of applies into the other interpretation of that pasuk in the Emor, which is that 6 days you can do work and 1 day you can't, which is there are 6 days that are Shabbos that's on one level and 1 day is not, meaning six are Yom Kippur.
The Vilna Gaon, yes.
Tapping into that version of that interpretation.
100%, exactly, because otherwise Shabbos is out of place in Perikot Gemara. And so this all relates to that idea. That's the Vilna Gaon, a very beautiful idea, which is also religious on one foot. Fantastic. So this is Rav Kook's interpretation of the, we'll call it the deeper machloikas of the Torah Shabbat, not Torah Shabbat. However, there's more afoot. Let's take an academic perspective. The Gemara tells us that one of the Baitusim had the gall and chutzpah to get up in front of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and say the following reason why he thinks that their system, in fact, is the better interpretation. Take a look at the bottom of page 6, source 10. Nit balehem Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai v'amalehem shoytin minayin lochem. He says, "Where do you get this from? Where did you you just suddenly open up the Bible one day and said, you know, hey, this is what I'm gonna, this is what I think is the interpretation. Where do you get that from?" So he says, "V'lo Adam Echad Shoya Me Shivoy." Nobody would answer him. He says, "Chutz Mizaken Echad." There was one elderly fellow from the sectarian group who got up and said, "Shem Mefat Bet Kenegdo Omer Moshe Rabbeinu Oiv Yisrael Haya." Sounds very Hasidish, right? Moshe Rabbeinu. He loved the nation of Israel so much. So therefore, v'yodaya sha'atzeres yom echad hu, and Shavuos, it's only 1 day. It's not like a 7-day affair like Pesach and Shavuos and Sukkos. Omad v'tikna achar Shabbos kadesh ye Yisrael misangim shnei yomim. It should be on the day after Shabbos. There should be like a long weekend. It's a long weekend, 2 days, right? All the Jews in Chutz are like, oh my goodness, 2 day Yom Tov is so hard, it's so difficult. He's saying, that was the point. He wanted to give them another day off. I remember I was in a taxi in Israel once, and I was speaking to this fellow, and it was one of those days where it turned out that it was Sukkos was Shabbos, 6 day Shabbos, right? Remember, so you get the full Chol HaMoed. It doesn't happen so often. And I was like, that's fantastic for trips and for all these things. It's great. So I was saying to the taxi driver, isn't it great to have like a full Chol HaMoed? He says, it's the worst year. He says, I lost all my days off. because, and I realized, for him, you know, Shabbos is the day off anyway, right? That's the weekend, the one day. And then Yom Tov would be the public holiday. Like we have Memorial Day in America, he has Sukkot's first day. And he lost it that year, right? And there's no makeup like, you know, July 4th, Monday kind of thing, right? He didn't have that. And I realized, you know, it's interesting when you can merge your experience of off with what we're with the Yom Tov, as opposed to Yom Tov being a burden. Yom Tov is actually the release, right? Which is actually, there's a lot to think about that in terms of experiencing our freedom in the framework of Yom Tov, as opposed to seeing it as an additional responsibility, with all the responsibilities that it brings. But that's what's happening. This fellow from the Baitusim group says it's the long weekend. That's why it's Sunday makes it longer. And it's fantastic. Everything works out. Now, it turns out that this logic actually doesn't work all the time, because it depends when Shavuos is, doesn't it? I mean, like, how could it be a two-day festival if it's Sunday is an extra day every year? It just depends, right? It depends. It depends how the house works, right? So, what he is essentially saying is, this is what do the cheshbon. You count from a Sunday, and now it's going to go all the way. So, essentially, every year, predictably, Shavuos will be a Sunday, which means you'll have a two day festival. That's what the Baitus is saying. However, it's also worthwhile knowing that what he's essentially saying is that it's easier to be predictable than non-predictable, right? Is that interesting? Not only are you getting a long weekend, it's easier to have something where every year, Shavuos, you know, I tell my boss ahead of time, right? Come the end of May, is around Memorial Day weekend, there's going to be one day that I need to take off extra. That's what the Baitusi would say. There's a certain convenience to that. It turns out that this argument wasn't just about Shavuos, and it wasn't just about Pesach or the Omer as well. In fact, Dr. Larry Schiffman has a book called Reclaiming the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's lives in Great Neck over here. He's a famed scholar, Jewish history. And he put out a book called Reclaiming the Dead Sea Scrolls. And in a certain chapter, he talks about the elements of calendar that relate to these sectarian groups. And listen to this following observation. He says, we have considerable evidence in Source 11 about the peculiar sectarian calendar. We also know that it was used by other groups of the Second Temple Jews as well, drawing upon a variety of Qumran texts, recently released. We can reconstruct the sect's calendar in its entirety. We know from Talmudic sources that the Baitusim, a group of Second Temple Jews closely linked to the Sadducees, as well as the authors of the apocryphal books of Jubilees and Enoch, advanced the same calendar. Okay, so what is this calendar? By the way, just to appreciate, Qumran refers to a certain group that live near the Dead Sea, and over the course of the last few years, they've discovered hundreds of scrolls, which are called the Dead Sea Scrolls, in caves around the northwestern corner of the Dead Sea. And the reason that these survived, even though most other biological scraps of material disappeared long ago, is because of the dryness of the air and the fact that they were covered and they were in pottery for all these years. And so we have these very, very long and extensive accounts of the sectarian group's Torah and essentially life in many ways, even though it wasn't for the Pharisees and the Rabbinic Judaism. There's a lot of fascinating aspects we can learn from these groups. So here's the calendar that they've reconstructed. The calendar consisted of 364 days, divided into 12 months of 30 days each. The months were calibrated according to the cycle of the sun. At the equinoxes and solstices, at the end of each three-month cycle, a 31st day was added to the month. Okay, so it essentially went in quarters of 91 days, 91 days, 91 days, 91 days, which is very convenient, right? Just so you should know, such a calendar was actually proposed in the Senate about 60 years ago here, for the sake of simplicity, because it was standardized the year, right? Essentially, as opposed to the calendar where we have, you know, 31 days and then 28 days and 30, right, and 31 days and then 30 days, which is standardized the calendar. He says, following this calendar helped to resolve the sectarians solve a thorny problem, establishing the date for holiday of Shavuot. According to the Bible, the Israelites will bring the Omer, the sacrifice, the sheath of barley, beginning on the morrow following the Sabbath after Pesach. From that day, they were to count 49 days. On the 50th day, they would celebrate the holiday of Shavuot, the festival of first fruit of wheat. Following the Pharisaic rabbinic tradition, began the counting on the day after the first day of the festival, because they understood Sabbath to mean festival, referring to the case of the first day of Passover. In contrast, the Dead Sea sect and the Baitusim interpreted Sabbath literally, so they began their count on a Sunday. We now know from Qumran evidence that this was the Sunday after the last day of the festival. That's what we just looked at, the Book of Jubilees. Under this system, the first day of the on the counting as well, as the legal holiday of Shavuot, always fell on a Sunday. The sectarian solemn calendar guaranteed sectarians legal interpretation of the Torah, which means that it would be that Pesach and Shavuot every year would always be on a Sunday, which means it would be a double long weekend, essentially. Actually, yeah, it would be a double long weekend every year. So every festival would always fall on the same day of the week every year. Pesach would always be on a Sunday. And then the, Pesach would be the previous week. Then there would be a Sunday, which would be the 26th of Nisan, essentially. And then the 15th of Sivan would always be Shavuot, which would always be a Sunday, based on the way their calendar would work, which affords everybody predictability, which affords everybody a calendar which one can expect. Everything is organized, orchestrated. It makes life much easier. You don't have to think, is it a 3-day Yom Tov this year? How are we going to invite the kids? When are we flying? When the Pesach program is lasting to? It's much easier to have a fixed calendar. What's one of the failings of this calendar? Yes, the problem is that again, the sun doesn't obey these nice little calendar things. Is that our ellipse around the sun is 365.25 and a number of other decimals after that day. So we fall short a day and a quarter, which means that the year is slowly shifting backwards according to this calendar, as convenient as it is. Now they've re-established this calendar. You can take a look. I just put it as some sort of mapping out of this calendar in the different quarters and how it looked. Very, very nice and very beautiful interpretation, and it would make their life much easier, but it doesn't work. But it goes further than this. Rav Yoel Ben Nun has an article on this topic, and he points out that the Jewish year is a complex year in that, unlike the Christian year, which is essentially solar, and unlike the world of Islam, which is totally lunar, right, which is why Ramadan keeps shifting backwards. The Jewish year goes in ebbs and flows, which means to say we have the solar parts of the year, which affects our harvest, which affects our equinoxes and solstices, and we have the lunar, which affects our festivals. But the Torah views the two as somehow connected to each other, and so the lunar year has to keep getting bumped up in order to click back into the solar space, the solar year as well. Where is the source of connecting those two calendars? Because the Torah says, Shamar es chodesh aviv. The Torah says, God, the fact, in Shmos Yud Beis, it says you need to make sure that Pesach, which is part of the lunar cycle, will always be in the aviv, which is the spring, which is the solar cycle. Which means we need to connect spring and Pesach, which are two separate cycles altogether. Right, and part of that obviously is reflected in the process that's happening. If we walk outside right now, the northern hemisphere, everything is rejuvenating. That which looked dead is now rejuvenating. Everything is coming together. It's very beautiful, right? And that's a reflection. That's a physical process reflective of the spiritual process of redemption, which is happening in the which is the idea of the renewed freedom, which is happening on an annual basis. Spiritually, is reflected in the physical surroundings around us. Very beautiful that this is going on. But if that's the case, if our calendar is the combination of both that which is mutable and immutable, solar and lunar, right? That which is flexible and that which is inflexible. And it starts off around which festival? It starts around the festival of Pesach. Then it's critical that if you think about it from this perspective, then it is critical that when it talks about the idea of the festivals of Mikra'e Kodesh in Perek Chof Gimel in Vayikra, it does throw in something which is immutable again, which is Sabbath. So the Torah is essentially combining both of those cycles, something which is immutable and that which is mutable or movable, by using a word that's out of place of Mimacharas HaShabbos to show us that our calendar is more complex. Our calendar requires not neat, we'll call it arrival of the facts and the statistics on the ground that works into our calendar, into our itinerary, but rather that there's a bigger picture afoot of connecting two systems that we experience as well. That's a very interesting observation that he makes. Be it as it may, as a reflection of what was not the debate was just the Torah Shavuot, Torah Shabbat, but rather also how the calendar itself works. How do you control time? Last interpretation, I'd like to close this because I think this is actually the most remarkable of all of this. The whole shiur is actually just building up towards this. Okay, so this is really I think is the most. Breathtaking in perspective, and that is the following. If you go back for a moment to that those psukim in Sefer Yehoshua, right? So we hear the nation of Israel arrives, they sacrifice the Korban Pesach on the 14th, then Mimachras HaPesach, they start eating Me'avur Aretz, right? So if you go back to those psukim, and just where's those psukim in Sefer Yehoshua? Just come back to those for a moment. Okay, what page is it?
Page 4.
Look at the last pasuk in that source, in Sefer Yehoshua. Vayishpois Haman mimacharas. The manna ceased from that day. Interesting. What word is it used to talk about cessation of the manna?
Shabbos.
Is that interesting? Maybe when the Torah says mimacharas haShabbos, it doesn't refer to Saturday. Maybe referring to something else. What's that? What's that? What else? Something which is about to happen, which is the cessation of the manna. Now, you say to yourself, okay, there are four men made this point. Let's think about this for a second. So you say, but what do the two have to do with each other? What does the manna have to do with the Omer? The answer is very simple. Let's go back to the manna in the first place. Let's come back to our section 3 here, where we're on the top page, page 9. The Torah tells us, so they came out and there was this layer of dew. They didn't know what this is. They said, what is this? So he says, this is the bread from heaven Hashem is giving us. What was the shiur, the measure that people would bring back into the houses of the manna every day? It was called an omer. Is that interesting? We don't really think of the two as connected to each other, but maybe our Korban HaOmer isn't just an agricultural cycle marker of the beginning of a festival. Maybe it's also reminding us that as we're harvesting this grain, there was an Omer. What was that Omer? It was how we survived for essentially 40 years in the desert based on another set of bread, which was an Omer Lagulgoles. So you say, he has an interesting piece, which is worthwhile thinking. This is our Sax's point. What day of the week did the man start falling on? Does anyone know? What day of the week? No? Good. That's when it's emphasized. That's when the new instructions are given. Everybody says, the Gemara Shavuos Pei Zayin Amud Beis. Rashi, at the beginning of this section, says, the man started falling on a Sunday. They needed to get new instructions on when? On Friday, because of they needed to adapt it for Shabbos, right? A double portion. But everybody agrees that the man started falling on Shabbos. When in history did... On a Sunday. When did the man stop or either falling or be accessible? Because it could be that they stopped falling a month before. When did the man stop being accessible to Israel in history? We just read the Pesukim. The day after the first day of Pesach. Maybe, listen to this remarkable interpretation of Rabbi Sacks. Maybe the debate that is between the Baitusim and the Perushim is they both agree that this is the process of the Omer is commemorating the manna because it's the Omer, right? That's how the Torah describes the collection. But the debate is, do you focus on the gift at the beginning, which is Mimacharas HaShabbos, which is on a Sunday, which is when it started falling, and therefore it's always on a Sunday? Or Mimacharas HaShabbos is when it stopped falling, which was the second day of Pesach. Is that a brilliant observation? Which means that history would explain itself out, that even though the Torah gave the interpretation in Parashas Emor of Mimacharas HaShabbos, we would only fully understand it from the day of cessation, which is in the future, which is in just a few years' time as they enter the land of Israel. And that would be the way we commemorate it. So you say to yourself, what's the logic of that? If we're both interpreting the Omer, what difference is it whether it's a Sunday, which is always a Sunday, or whether it's the day after Pesach? So Rabbi Sachs's argument is the following, is that if you read historically speaking, the sectarian groups like the Samaritans, the Sadducees, and so on, were the more leisured class. They were the upper class in Israel. In fact, for the last century, they were the controllers of the Beis HaMikdash to a large degree. Many of the high priests were Sadducees, even up to the time of its destruction. We're already tzedakim at this point in time. They were the upper class, middle to upper class. Whereas the Perushim, generally speaking, were the middle average working class, the rabbinic Judaism. The question is when you want to commemorate the Omer, what are you, ideologically, what are you commemorating? Are you commemorating the fact that God gave us the ability to have enough sustenance to be able to do what we wanted, to sit there philosophically in our ivory towers thinking and pontificating and writing, as the Sadducees would have, which is therefore interpreting the beginning of the manna period, the period of the most ideal period in Jewish history? Or do you say that the most ideal period in Jewish history began when the manna stopped and we picked up our pitchforks, and we picked up our hoes, and we started making the breaking the ground to work ourselves? The argument of the Purushim in understanding that it was Mimochas HaPesa, HaShabbos, referring to the cessation of the man, was the celebration of the work necessary of coming into the land of Israel. Which means, yes, we remember that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked after us for 40 years, but that's not how he wanted us to be. He wanted us to take that platform and now move into the land of Israel and start working on it for the next stage as well. So if you think about that for a moment, why would the Torah call it Mimochas HaShabbos? So the answer is if you look at creation for a moment and you appreciate what happened in creation, all the 7 days of creation, it was God doing, right? Even the Yom HaShvi is a reflection and appreciation of what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did in the first 6 days. What happened after Shabbos? Why do we do Havdalah? The Gemara tells us. Because afterwards was that Hashem allowed us to have the wisdom to create flame, fire. That was when we started working. Which means there were 7 days of creation about God's work. What does Mimochas HaShabbos mean? It means ideologically, in a Pavlovian way, when we think about after the first Shabbos is the day when humans started working. Therefore, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is essentially saying is Mimochas HaShabbos is after the day that I finished doing my job, that was called the manna, I want you to start doing your job. And that's called tilling the land of Israel. That's the next stage over here. That's what's afoot over here. A remarkable perspective, because there is no other commemoration, if you think about it, of the man, except for the Tzinsenes HaMan in the Kodesh Kodashim. But according to this, every time we bring the Korban, we are thinking about the historical pattern of our survival in the desert, our thrival, and our arrival in the land of Israel, and our ideological involvement where Hashem wants us to be, which is the next stage as well. What a different perspective on things. Rabbi, I hope this has been illuminating. Three perspectives. Torah Shabbat Peh, Torah Shabbat Chsav. The idea of the calendar control and the idea of the manna as a commemoration of the beginning or the end. Thank you so much for taking the time. Have a wonderful and meaningful day.